Russia calls for the restoration of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, blaming U.S. anti-Iran sanctions for hampering the implementation of the accord. The UN Human Rights Office asked the United Arab Emirates for proof that the daughter of Dubai's ruler, who was held captive against her will, is alive. And also, gunfire and rockets rock the Somali capital Mogadishu as government forces clash with opposition supporters who are angered by delayed presidential election. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Russia has called for the restoration of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, blaming the U.S. anti-Iran sanctions for hampering the implementation of the international accord. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov, however, welcomed the new U.S. administration's initial steps to find a compromise on the deal, but said more work is needed. That after Washington reversed two anti-Iran steps taken by the previous administration. They included calls for international sanctions on Tehran and curbs on Iranian diplomats in New York. Washington has, however, conditioned its return to the nuclear deal on Iran's full compliance. Tehran says it will reverse its commitments, cuts once the U.S. returns to the accord and, quote, unconditionally and effectively lifts all its sanctions. China has also said that the U.S. return to the deal is the only proper way to resolve the deadlock.
The fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal still remains uncertain. The United States says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord. Tehran, however, argues that it was Washington that walked away from the international accord and hence it should first fulfill all its obligations, including the lifting of sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Now China has once again called on the U.S. to return to the deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, saying it is the only proper way to resolve the deadlock over the issue.
China always believes that the U.S. return to the JCPOA is the only way to resolve the deadlock in the Iran nuclear issue. All parties should feel the urgency to work together to implement the consensus reached during the Foreign Ministers' Conference on the Iran nuclear issue in last December, and urge the U.S. side to return to the JCPOA unconditionally as soon as possible while lifting all sanctions against Iran.
Meanwhile, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said the new U.S. administration needs to act swiftly to make up for Washington's past mistakes and return to the rule of law. Rouhani stressed that the Iranian nation will never bow to U.S. bullying. On Wednesday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said what Tehran wants to see from the other parties to the nuclear deal is action, not words. The new U.S. President, Joe Biden, has signaled a willingness to rejoin the JCPOA, but his administration has conditioned the move on Tehran's resumption of its commitments. Tehran has repeatedly said it will accept no precondition for the return of the United States to the agreement. Iran recently announced that it has decided to suspend the snap inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Officials said the move would be in line with the Iranian parliament's recent legislation called the Strategic Action Plan to counter sanctions. Tehran, however, noted that the decision does not mean ending all IAEA inspections of its nuclear facilities. In reaction, the UN nuclear watchdog said its director, Rafael Mariano Grossi, will travel to Iran to discuss the issue. After the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories to the deal to make up for the U.S. pullout. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments, prompting Tehran to scale back on its commitments under the accord. However, Iran has time and again said that their measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by the remaining signatories. Now questions arise as to whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or try to rectify the Trump-era policy against Iran, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's closest allies.
U.S. President Joe Biden delivering a speech to the virtual Munich security meeting. Let's quickly go over what was just said. Mr. Biden described, first of all, the transatlantic alliance as a strong base for partnership and that the U.S. Is to work with EU partners to resolve common challenges. He said that the U.S. was reviewing the Trump-imposed cap on troops number that can be deployed to Germany. He also spoke about the importance of democracy in his closing statements, as you heard as well. stating that we have to defend and protect democracy. This is while his presidency is being contested, or has been contested with voter fraud by his former presidential opponent and former U.S. President Donald Trump. Biden also welcomed tough competition with China, and in closing statements also stated that the United States has yet again officially rejoined the Paris Agreement, and that Washington has remained grateful for the EU's continued leadership on the issue of climate change. That's it with the latest of the address of the U.S. President to the virtual Munich security meeting. We'll keep you posted on the details of that story and much more as we get it for you. We're going to return to the normal course of programming for now. Well, the UN Human Rights Watchdog has asked the United Arab Emirates to provide more information on the status of Sheikha Latifa, the daughter of Dubai's ruler. A spokeswoman for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights said they raised concerns about the situation following the disturbing video evidence that emerged this week. She added that they requested the UAE for clarification on Latifa's current situation and proof that she is alive. UN bodies said it will continue to monitor the situation closely. The British media on Tuesday released videos in which Latifa said she was being held against her will in a barricaded villa and that she fears for her life. The princess had tried to escape the country in 2018, but was captured and returned back to the UAE. Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Yemen's city of Ma'rib. That's according to Yemen's Supreme Council for Management of Humanitarian Affairs. The council is part of the government that Ansar and its allies run in Sana'a. The council said Saudi-backed militants are seeking to stop Ansar forces and their allied army units advance in Ma'rib. It said Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Ma'rib is a stronghold of loyalists of the former Yemeni government. On Thursday, Ansar Allah deployed troops to the city, saying it aims to protect citizens there. The movement and its allies have been fighting Saudi Arabia and its loyalists since the Yemen war began 6 years ago. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. Stay tuned, everybody. On this edition of the news review, Somali government forces have clashed with opposition supporters angered by the delayed presidential election. Well, security forces fired live ammunition as protesters hit the streets of the capital, Mogadishu. The march was being led by presidential candidates, including prominent opposition leader Abdurrahman Abdi Shakur Warsami. Somali politicians were due to select a new president earlier this month. The process was delayed after the opposition accused incumbent Muhammad Abdullahi Farmaajo of filling electoral boards with his supporters. Political rivalries could play into the hands of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group that has been engaged in bloodshed for years. Al-Shabaab is seeking to overthrow the African country's internationally backed government. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have broadcaster and political analyst Julius Mbaluto joining us from London. Also from Abuja, we have co-convener of the Center for Liberty, Mr. Ario Ayote. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Mbaluto in London. Julius, talk to us about the recent unrest and what is it that the opposition supporters are angered about or angered by?
Well, Somalia at the moment is at a very critical point in time. Somalia, since, you know, after fighting for over like 20 years in conflict, civil war, the hope came by the beginnings of transitional federal government, which actually happened in Kenya and then it was transferred to Somalia. But now where we are right now, since that time, Somalia has embraced a very complex system of, election, whereby you have a situation clan elders elect MPs, and then it is the MPs that end up electing the president. Now, successful as it has been in the past, because it's what produced the current government, incumbent government, at the time to end that period has come, whereby the time to be in office has ended. But that time hence when they haven't conducted elections for the next government. And that's where the problem comes. Of course, we have issues there, which is what caused all this delay in election. The Somalia government has got about 5 regions, and each region has got a president. And then you have now, right now, if the 5 regions were in agreement, election would have taken place. But we have 2 regions, which is Jubaland and Puntland, that have refused to take election. They've got their concerns. They want a bit of more autonomy and influence in the national government. And also, if you take all that to the opposition, they are talking about that they don't have a lot of confidence in the electoral body itself. And therefore, issues are there now. The key issue is to have a proper format of elections, and also at the same time to get all these delegates from different regions coming to an agreement. There was hope not long ago that they were to come together, the five presidents from the regions coming together to meet with the current president, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, or Fajo as they call him, to talk these things throughout. But that process has been delayed, and this delay is what has caused now the opposition to begin to protest.
Right.
At the moment, that's where we are right now.
Mr. Ayote, give us your thoughts on the presidential impasse right now in Somalia, and whether you foresee a short-term a solution in the short term.
Well, thank you again for having me. My name is Ariyo Daria Toye from Abuja, Nigeria. And let me say this. I think we have to put this blame squarely on Farmajo, that's President Mohamed Hey Mohamed. Because when you looked at the victory secured about 4 years ago, which was a welcome, including even in the opposition clan, you realize that he has failed enormously to unite this clan and to unite the regions, for them to be able to live peacefully, to bring them together to be able to possibly defeat Al-Shabaab. But look, his time expired, I think, on February 8th. He failed to do that. And what he's currently doing is that he's not even putting anything in place to assure either both the local and the international community of what he seeks to do. At least let there be a sort of a reassurance in terms of, is there a definite date? That is the only thing that can actually calm Frenage. And this demonstration that we've seen in Mogadishu is likely to continue. And from what we've seen, the opposition's members have vowed to continue. My worry is that with what we saw, where the opposition were also guided by militia men carrying weapons, I'm worried, and the international community is actually worried now that this can escalate into a serious civil war if it's not quickly nipped in the bud. And I think the international community are not friends of Somalia. It is time for them to prevail on Farmajo to possibly quickly enter into an agreement and a meeting on a possible date, for an election. And I believe that is the only way out of this logjam. There must be a definite statement on the way forward in terms of when and how to conduct this election. I agree that there are other regions who are actually trying to seek autonomy because, look, the process of electing a president is a very clumsy and unique one in Somalia. However, I believe that must have also been to the failure of which terms has expired to actually bring care, because judging from the election he won 4 years ago, then it's obvious that he has not done enough. So the only way out is for him to actually, probably with the help of the international community, to convene a quick meeting for them to reach a sort of a consensus on when and how to hold a future election.
One last question for you, Mr. Mbalutu. How will the political rivalries in Somalia play into the hands of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group?
We do have what they call 4.5 system, and this 4.5 system is, as I said earlier, is purely based on clan leadership. And this clan leadership is actually not giving prominence to competence and belonging to a particular clan. Now, when this is in place, kind of not the best way for to conduct elections, because number one, legitimacy is a bit more into question. We talk about Somalia. The last time they had proper election was 1969. That proper election whereby everybody participates. The idea of 4.5 system has been put to question by a lot of Somalians. They're like, we haven't participated. It's the clan elders who are electing MPs, and then MPs electing the president. So it's totally unrepresentative. That's the way it's been seen by Somalian people on the ground. And therefore, number one, that has got to be resolved, whereby you bring on board all Somalian people to feel they are participating in the process. And now when we talk about the thorny issue, which is the clan, the regional game, which is also based on clan leadership again, brings out a big question to where do they end up. Number one, the 4.5 system has been accused because it's purely based on the clan system and dividing people on clan basis. Now, when you talk about all these organized government, national government focused system, which seems to be divisive, that division alone is a great threat to security of Somalia, because that is what actually Al-Shabaab will come and exploit to the detriment of the country. So okay, unity is key, very key among the regions, but also unity between clans, and that calls leadership, especially from the president.
All right, we're short of time. I'm going to have to interrupt you there. Thanks to Mr. Julius Mbalutu joining us from London. Also, thanks to Ariel Ayote joining us from Abuja. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Protests have erupted in Barcelona and other cities across Spain for the third night in a row to demand freedom of a jailed rapper, Pablo Hasél, who was sentenced to 9 months for insulting the Spanish monarchy and state institutions. Protesters clashed with riot police and burned containers. Over 80 people have been arrested and more than 100 injured since the singer was led away to jail by the police after refusing to turn himself in. Cosay Kedri reports.
The streets of Barcelona erupted in flames for the third night in a row in protest of the imprisonment of a rapper who has been sent to jail for slander, libel, and the glorification of terrorism. Rioters set fire to trash containers as they tried to set up barricades against the police. Over 80 people have been arrested and more than 100 injured since rapper Pablo Hasél was led away to jail by the police on Tuesday after refusing to turn himself in. His vitriolic lyrics and tweets against the monarchy, the courts, the police earned many adversaries but made him popular across Spain, particularly among the young and the disgruntled. Musicians say they worry that the right to freedom of expression in Spain is being eroded. Many people across Catalonia and Spain, however, condemned the trail of destruction left by the rioting and looting over the past 3 days. Under growing pressure from rights groups and the general public, the left-leaning coalition government in Madrid said it was planning to revive stalled talks over the repeal of the infamous citizen security law, also known as gag law. It announced it will scrap prison terms for offenses involving freedom of expression, but the rapper may not benefit from the announced reform.
As protests for Hasél become more violent and damaging to public property, the troubles of the singer with the courts have taken a turn for the worse, with his sentencing to 2.5 years for obstruction of justice and threat to a witness. Cosay Kedri, Barcelona.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Light. If you walk through London these days, you will spot tiny handmade shops in some places. The shops have been created by an artist to encourage people to donate non-perishable food to charities. Sean Rodrigo makes wooden miniature food banks and puts them in different areas. He uses a 3D printer to create his artwork. Rodrigo believes decorated boxes shaped like shops grab people's attention. Each box holds about 35 cans.
It's really difficult and often painful to put a smile on kids' faces, especially when they're sick and they are suffering from chronic diseases. But a group in superhero costumes in Austria has taken a courageous move to cheer up young patients on International Childhood Cancer Day. Vienna's Special Forces police officers agreed to visit the children's hospital dressing up as Spider-Man, Batman, and other superheroes. The young patients were excited and delighted to see them through windows while they scrawled on the walls of the hospital. The officers' brass band also played familiar songs from Star Wars to amuse the children. The visit was planned by hospital officials and volunteer officers in order to cheer up these little warriors who are fighting the diseases every day.
Thai brides and grooms have said, "I do," in a special wedding ceremony on Valentine's Day. 59 couples tied the knot on elephants during the ceremony in Thailand's Chonburi province. The elephant bag wedding is actually an annual event. It takes place in a botanical garden. In previous years, over 100 couples attended the ceremony, but this year, the number was half that due to the pandemic.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of the pandas is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to five giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
Chinese villagers cook local dishes as they mark the start of the Lunar New Year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated throughout East Asia and has always been the most important holiday of the year in that region. For many people, it's a two-week celebration culminating in fireworks, red envelopes with gifts, and most importantly, a sumptuous feast. The elaborate meal preparation allows the family to spend more time together and celebrate the New Year. The auspicious symbolism of these traditional foods is based on their pronunciations and appearances. Not only do the dishes themselves matter, but also the preparation and ways of serving and even enjoying them mean a lot. In the northwestern province of Shanxi, villagers use a 3,000-year-old recipe to make huamo, a kind of floury steamed bun in a variety of festive shapes, including Chinese zodiacs. As you know, 2021 is the lunar year of the ox.
Australia is offering environmentally friendly kayak tours in Sydney Harbour to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbour. Each month about 20 such tours take place. They collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organisers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world, but once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there, so I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally each year. Experts say that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean. people throughout China and in many countries across the globe have begun celebrations marking the start of Chinese Lunar New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. February the 12th is the beginning of the Year of the Ox, based on the Chinese calendar. A variety of activities featuring traditional Chinese culture and folk performances mark the occasion in China and neighboring states Malaysia, Japan, and Vietnam. Releasing lanterns and setting off fireworks are part of the event. It's also the time for families to be together as the day starts with a week-long official public holiday. The festive mood is also seen in Europe as well as in Australia. Sydney was one of the first cities to kick off celebrations.
It's meant to be a year of economic prosperity, which we need after COVID, a year of good health, which we need so we can, you know, mix and get back to a normal way of life. But it would be good if we have good relations with all of our neighbours.
The Italian city of Milan also joined the celebrations, with its highest building being lit up in red for the fourth consecutive year. Every year, millions of people in China and elsewhere in the world welcome and celebrate the Spring Festival. The occasion attracts hundreds of thousands of tourists to China. However, border closures and travel bans due to the COVID-19 pandemic have reduced the crowd this year, forcing many people to sit home and watch the festivities online.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
A German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Iran Today.
The U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA, on 8th May 2018. That was under its recently terminated former administration. With Joe Biden taking office as U.S. president, hopes ran high for that joint comprehensive plan of action, which he pledged to re-enter in his election campaign. But now he's ushering Iran to go first, to recommit to its obligations under the deal, so the U.S. would follow by returning to the deal. Oh, but Iran insists, it was you that left the deal. You took the first step out, so you take the first step back, or else.
a December urgency law is to get into action on the 21st of February, and that will mean the end of free visits for nuclear inspectors to Iran who've been living in this country since the JCPOA of 2015, unless the new U.S. administration returns to the deal unconditionally. But it looks like Joe Biden is banking on his 4 terms in office. Alas, action can't wait a full term. I'm Leila Faramazia.
So, the Biden administration is now talking of mincing its way back into the deal only after Iran begins recommitting. The deal was between Iran and the UN Security Council permanent members. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. Under UN Security Council Resolution 2231, the purpose of the deal was to curb Iran's nuclear program in return for lifting UN economic nuclear-related sanctions off this country. Iran complied, as verified 15 times, no less, by the UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA. Still, the US pulled out unilaterally and reinstated all UN sanctions as US sanctions. It has been a long-drawn process, and now economic sanctions are practically as good as sanctions on food, health, and medicine. Mr. Mackey is a political analyst who kindly makes the trip to Press TV studios for interviews. We had him on the show yet again.
Given all America's deal-breaking during its former administration, the whole world doesn't trust that country anymore, let alone Iran. So what hope do you see, really, for the revival of the JCPOA?
By signing the JCPOA, the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown that the only solution to the problems and all the challenges that exist in Iran's relations with the West can be resolved through dialogue and negotiation, and that there's no issue that cannot be resolved. It's unlikely for the U.S. to be able to continue pushing its proposals and plans to return to the JCPOA. It's an issue that can be resolved. Making simultaneous and concurrent moves to return to commitments is a logical idea. It's unlikely that the European governments will stay on the U.S. side for long. They will try to lay the groundwork for lifting sanctions and returning to commitments by consulting and negotiating with the parties to the deal.
Iran has come to a point where it refuses to sit and wait for its rights to be thrown at it breadcrumb at a time. So it decided to further exert pressure on Western signatories to the deal to get sanctions lifted once and for all. That is why on December 2, 2020, Parliament proposed the said law, the Strategic Act of the Islamic Consultative Assembly to remove sanctions. Mr. Izadi is professor of American studies. I'm sure you'll find his viewpoint interesting.
The West insists on adding clauses to the JCPOA, such as interference with Iran's regional policy, scrapping its missile program. Where does this stem from? How much might it have to do with our regional rivals?
I think it's U.S. imperialism, basically. The United States wants to dictate its policies towards Iran, whether people in the White House belong to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. And U.S. allies in the region basically take the lead from the United States. So I think the main problem is the United States. And the fact that Biden administration actually likes what Trump did to Iran, that's a problem.
Our experts say what they think of Iran's strategy of demanding a U.S. return to the deal before Iran recommits to lower levels of uranium enrichment with less advanced centrifuges in only the Natanz nuclear site. But please note, more important than a U.S. return to the deal is the U.S.'s lifting sanctions off this country. A U.S. return without sanctions relief would mean nothing. The Iranian leader's recent speech in response to U.S. policy has triggered Iranian strategy. Mr. Abolfat is an expert on Iran-America relations and an asset to the TV company. Press TV borrows him from time to time.
It appears Iran may have to further pressure other parties to the JCPOA, the Western parties to the JCPOA. What do you think Iran can now do?
Iran has not left the JCPOA. Iran remains a party to this multilateral agreement. Even a year after Donald Trump announced the U.S. withdrawal from the accord, Iran remained fully committed to the JCPOA. And the International Atomic Energy Agency issued periodic reports stating that Iran had fully complied with these obligations. But a year after it became clear that the Americans were not going to live up to their commitments and the Europeans were unable to meet their obligations, the Islamic Republic announced that it was gradually scaling back some of its commitments, while stressing that all those steps were reversible. Tehran said as soon as the other side, that is, the United States and Europe, fulfill their obligations, it will go back into full compliance.
Without sanctions relief, the deal would mean nothing because the whole point of the deal was that Iran show goodwill in proving its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes only, in return for sanctions lifting to encourage foreign trade with Iran, therefore boosting this country's economy. Whereas, never mind industrial or arms imports, even foreign clothes are hard to come by in Iran now.
The fact is that the solution to return to the JCPOA is not complicated. If there is a will to lift the sanctions and return to the JCPOA, it can be done with an executive order from US President Joe Biden. But the Americans have always tried to have the upper hand in negotiations with Iran, even when the blame rests with them.
As a first step in reviving the JCPOA, Iran not only expects sanctions to be lifted before it recommits, it demands to verify U.S. actions before recomplying. The next step would be for the U.S. to compensate this country and its trade partners. Compensate for the damage Donald Trump's sanctions have done us and companies that suffered secondary sanctions for dealing with Iran. The unilateral U.S. sanctions are deemed illegal by experts at large, by the way.
As Parliament prepares to vote, I await my interviewee MP, whom I'll be bringing to you shortly with his viewpoint.
It's the Parliamentary Deputy Speaker, Mr. Ghazizadeh Hashemi, I bring you.
We expect that after all these years that we showed unilateral tolerance, Americans will live up to their commitments. First, they need to prove that they are trustworthy and spout off after. The Americans, whether the Democratic Obama, whose vice president was Mr. Biden, or the Republican Trump, are unreliable to us and must act to gain our trust. It's that simple.
Another MP I got to talk to is Mr. Rastine. It's his first tenure, but he appears to possess the passion to attempt long strides in any amount of time given.
Time is running out to salvage the JCPOA, that they call a landmark international deal. We are days away from the end of the deal. The U.S. and European countries should try and prize these remaining days by returning to their commitments, removing all sanctions, and facilitating the return of all the frozen assets of Iran to Tehran. Otherwise, the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown that it insists on the implementation of the Parliament's resolution.
We wrote the law to lift the sanctions according to Article 36 of the JCPOA, because the same law allows us to suspend some of our commitments if the West doesn't honor its obligations. We are still a party to the deal. We haven't withdrawn our participation from it. They need to carry out their commitments, so we do ours.
Now, while Iran proposes more for more, the U.S. is mincing in with an offer or demand of less for less. And Iran's said law may be their excuse for this, whereas Iran's law is a reaction to the U.S. pullout and the EU's lack of commitment to the deal to begin with. The E3 are the UK, France and Germany. They pledged to safeguard Iran's interests against the US pullout by enacting an updated blocking statute on 7th August 2018 to nullify US sanctions on countries trading with Iran.
This was followed by a couple of trade mechanisms finally known as INSTEX, Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges. But nothing worked in the face of U.S. belligerence and European lack of will. Europe has, for its part, been trying to inch in with new demands to an already agreed deal, say, curbing Iran's regional presence and scrapping its ballistic missile program, when the deal was solely to supervise and control Iran's nuclear activity. But that backfired. I said the West strategy had backfired. Asking for more has meant getting less.
Iran's parliament has passed a law, and I think the executive branch will follow that law. Iran has a peaceful nuclear program. There is no reason for Iran to follow every restraint on its nuclear program that is under the nuclear agreement, because the other side is not following it. So Iran will continue its peaceful activities under NPT.
Now, what does Iran's said law exactly comprise? This policy of maximum or wise resistance manifested in maximum pressure on the U.S. and the international community. It's inked in a range of arenas, while aiming to get all sanctions on Iran lifted with Iran compensated for damages. It demands Iran's nuclear accomplishments to date be leveraged.
Iran has started enriching uranium to 20% purity. Iran has taken major step in the production of metallic uranium, and the deadline for the implementation of a parliament resolution is imminent. So Iran has chosen maximum resistance and maximum retaliation against their maximum pressure.
But so far, these Iranian measures haven't been enough. Our MP gives us an example of how far Iran might next go to exert further pressure on the West.
Certainly, the Islamic Republic will end the additional cooperation with the IAEA based on this resolution. This means that the additional protocol, which is a set of extra rules setting Iran's diplomatic, technical, and scientific relations with the IAEA, will surely expire, and Iran will end the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol.
No one can trust the United States. The experience of negotiations and talks with Washington over the past decade has shown that the Americans are highly unreliable and have to be spoken to with distrust.
Our narrative still goes on, but let's give a chance to other media outlets for a bit to see what they have to say on the issue. And what would be our other media outlets of the day? Newsweek and Ausat. Newsweek tells of how Iran is going to replace the West, possibly. Iran courts China-Russia as new nuclear deal with declining U.S. storms. Iranian officials are continuing to build stronger ties with Russia and China as Tehran faces what could be a prolonged standoff with President Joe Biden over any possible revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, or nuclear deal. Biden is demanding that Iran scale back its nuclear program in line with JCPOA restrictions before American sanctions are lifted. However, Iranian leaders have said they will not return to compliance until the U.S. eases sanctions and does the same. Tehran is casting around for allies to help offset American pressure, along with the threat from regional U.S. allies like Israel and Saudi Arabia. Russia and China have repeatedly spoken out against Trump's withdrawal from the deal and have urged Biden to recommit to the accord with no conditions. In recent weeks, Tehran has been lauding ties with both countries as the nuclear issue remains stalled. Now, French President Macron has offered to broker talks with Israel and Saudi Arabia present, and Ausat refers exactly to that. Iran snubs Macron's offer to mediate Washington-Tehran nuclear talks. Tehran has rejected French President Emmanuel Macron's offer to be an honest broker in talks between Iran and the U.S. The nuclear deal has no need for a mediator, Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh told reporters, without specifically mentioning France. but in response to a question about recent comments by the country's president. Khatibzadeh also insisted that there was no need to renegotiate the nuclear deal. When a document is written with such precision and length, it means it is not necessary to discuss it again. It is all there in more than 150 pages, he said, of the deal officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The spokesman added that European states must themselves return to their commitments under the nuclear deal with Iran. Newsweek tells of how an Iranian commander has shown Iran doesn't have to be passive. Iran commander tells US take a lesson from military drills amid nuclear deal standoff. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, is celebrating the service's most recent military drills, saying the US and other enemies should take a lesson from the firepower on display. IRGC Commander Major General Hossein Salami told reporters that the Great Prophet military exercises held last week, beginning February the 9th, in Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan, showcased the service's authority, defense, resistance, and aggression, according to Mehr News Agency. The ground forces of the IRGC guarantee our security, independence, honor, and dignity, and they shone brightly in their latest war game, Salami said, on the sidelines of the drill. The enemy should take a lesson from the firepower showcased by Iranian forces, he added, a reference to the U.S. and regional enemies like Israel and Saudi Arabia. So that's it for the news segment. Do stay with me for the continuation of our own narrative.
There's more to Iran's December law. It also demands the blockade of European initiatives to include the issue of Iran's ballistic missile development, enriching uranium to a high level, 20%, enriching uranium using advanced generation centrifuges, the passage in Majlis or Parliament of legislation for non-cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, and expulsion of its inspectors. More demands coming up in a bit.
The message of the Parliament's strategic action to the United States was that one cannot claim they adhere to the rule of law and maintain favorable diplomatic relations, all the while disrupting the international law with their inappropriate and destructive behavior.
Iran's maximum resistance policy further demands, in the ballistic missile arena, using the launch of satellites into space as civilian scientific activity, to demonstrate Iran's capability in producing long-range missiles. In the conventional military arena, shows of conventional strength by conducting extensive military exercises to include the use of advanced suicide drones. In the political arena, it insists on all-out diplomatic pressure to safeguard Iran's nuclear program, which is a national project agreed by all the country's institutions.
Looking at the situation from Tehran, you realize that being flexible with the Americans is the most stupid thing that you can do, because they don't value cooperation. So Iran is not going to make the same mistake that Iran did with the Obama administration, basically trusting the American government to continue its commitments after an administration has finished.
And why is Iran so adamant in combating sanctions and strengthening its position? A look at sanctions imposed on this country after the U.S. trashed the JCPOA in May 2018 should suffice to answer that. They almost immediately began in November 2018. To summarize, in September 2019, a U.S. official stated that the United States will sanction whoever deals with Iran or purchases its oil. Also in September 2019, new sanctions targeted the Iranian National Bank. On 21st February 2020, Iran was placed on the FATF blacklist. FATF being the Financial Action Task Force, an intergovernmental organization for combating money laundering. Next, the U.S. proposed to extend the global arms embargo on Iran. But the United Nations Security Council rejected that resolution. Hence, the U.S. moved to unilaterally trigger snapback sanctions, although it had walked away from the Iran nuclear deal and no longer had logical, legitimate claim on it.
It seems the Biden administration, it doesn't know if they like the Trump administration policies towards Iran or not. It seems that they criticize Trump a lot, but they actually like Trump policies towards Iran, and they want to keep those policies, and they keep talking about leverage. They like leverage, which means they like sanctions.
In September 2020, then-President Trump imposed sweeping new sanctions on Iran to curb its missile and conventional arms programs. On the 8th of October 2020, the U.S. targeted 18 Iranian banks.
Question is, why this pursuit of a maximum pressure policy when it has failed? The goal was basically to bring Iran to its knees by bringing its oil exports down to zero, whereas those exports have slowly but steadily only increased, after a serious low, of course, since the U.S.'s harshest ever sanctions.
And now oil analysts foresee an additional 500,000 Iranian oil barrels coming back on the market in the next 2 to 3 months, possibly with U.S. approval.
The intensification of sanctions is no longer a major concern for Iran, because there are no more sanctions left to be imposed now. Even if the Europeans want to join the United States in introducing sanctions, there is nothing left to boycott. As a result, sanctions as a tool has lost its function against Iran.
The revolution's leaders' take on the matter pretty much sums it all up. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said in reference to former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton and his boss Donald Trump, one of those first-rate fools said they would celebrate New Year 2019 in Tehran. That person has been sent to history's trash can, and his boss has also been kicked out of the White House with disgrace. But the Islamic Republic is still standing on its feet with God's grace. The nuclear deal was to control Iran's nuclear program and none else. But for argument's sake, Foreign Minister Zarif said, when Iran has no nuclear weapons, talk about missiles with nuclear warheads is meaningless. Secondly, the parties to the JCPOA, whose annual sales of weapons to the region have amounted to over $100 billion, are in no position to tell Iran to forgo its missile defenses. The Europeans and Americans should know that we will not discuss what has already been resolved. This would be against the rules of negotiation.
That's it for today. Thanks for watching from the whole team. The episode has come to an end, but remember, the show goes on. Bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.